Hello, thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And get show notes and other links that you may find interesting by checking out the website armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Don't forget the special deal for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In the offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Basically, if you buy directly from Hearst, it's cheaper than Amazon. And perhaps more importantly, buying a book this way is a good way for you to help support this podcast. The offer includes sociologist Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State, while all the other books on the list are written by authors who have previously featured on this podcast. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and if you do decide to buy, you'll be helping to support the Turkey Book Talk podcast. Another way to support if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now on with this latest episode, in which I speak to Cemil Aydın. He's the author of a fine new book, The Idea of the Muslim World, A Global Intellectual History, which is published by Harvard University Press. My review of it will be published in the Times Literary Supplement in the coming weeks. The book is a bracing and provocative read, which outright denies the existence of what we know today as the Muslim world. Aydın argues that the idea that there is a discrete Muslim world with a set of shared, essential, civilization-defining characteristics is little more than ahistorical romanticism, a fantastical illusion which has never really existed in any meaningful form. Today there are roughly 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, located in every corner of the globe and varying in language, ethnicity, political ideology, nationality, culture and wealth. It is, Aydın writes, naive to categorize these people, in all their diversity, as any kind of unity, and particularly a political one. He traces the emergence of this misleading idea of the Muslim world back to the late 19th century, the rise of European imperialism, and the response by many Muslim intellectuals. Ironically, the idea of the Muslim world actually came to be cherished by Islamophobes and pan-Islamists alike, and that remains the case today. The Idea of the Muslim World is a very tightly argued and dense book, but I started by asking Cemil Aydın to try to summarize in broad terms the argument he makes.
So the book's main argument is a focus on the way racializations of Muslims in Europe and America from imperial times in the late 19th century all the way to the present rely on this notion of a Muslim unity, a geopolitical unity based on their religious identity. Racializations of different non-European societies happened for Asians, for Africans, for so many other groups. The late 19th century age of empire is also age of race and racial thinking. So the book is telling that being Muslim was a racial category in the late 19th century. So the Europeans always perceived Muslims as one racial group via their religion, like similar to Jews and Hindus. But different than the Jews, who were seen as an internal enemy, Muslims were also seen as a political threat outside with a large population and a large geopolitical strength. But the book, after making this point, really focuses on this issue that why this racial thinking about Muslims inherited from imperial era did not fade away with decolonization. On the contrary, it actually came back in the Cold War as part of some sort of Cold War geopolitical alliances. And then there's the second repetition of racialization of Muslims in the West in the 1980s, inheriting the template from the imperial era, but using it for very different political purposes. So the book focuses on the kind of re-emergence of the Muslim world in the 1980s as well, about a period of time we are still dealing with. So the book starts with Barack Obama's speech to the Muslim world and trying to show why that speech actually relies on this racialized notion of the existence of the Muslim world. Muslims from Senegal and Nigeria to Morocco to Indonesia, they're just nothing else but primarily Muslim, and that defines them. While saying that, it also argue how pan-Islamist, Muslim modernists, and 1980s political Islam similarly embrace this notion of the existence of the Muslim world, then link it to the earlier notions of the Ummah. For counter-imperial purposes or nationalist or geopolitical purposes, while doing that, they also established a symbiotic relationship between pan-Islamism and European racism towards Muslim. So the book invites us to kind of remember how this idea came into being, for what different political purposes it has been used for, so that we can critique it and overcome it and try to think differently about Muslims and politics. And that's why I want to kind of invite the readers to think their belief in the idea of a Muslim unity and the Muslim world, which is an essential basis of not seeing them as individuals, as people with citizenship, with claims, with rights, but seeing them as representative or tools or pawns or extension of a dangerous geopolitical bloc. And that affects, of course, especially the rights of Muslims in Europe and in America. And it encourages this geopolitical posturing and proxy game that any person who wants to be the leader of the Muslim world now is also appealing for Muslims in Britain and Europe to do something because they think they are just the infiltrating tool of an expanding Islamic world.
One of the fascinating things in the book is the way that you describe how this idea of the Muslim world emerged in the late 19th century, really. It's really, as you describe it, it was really a break with centuries of history before, when this idea really didn't make any sense.
Yes.
Could you just describe how this break emerged?
Yeah, since the book is struggling against a couple of powerful narratives like Clash of Civilization, Islam versus the West, it reminds us that this story of an eternal conflict between Islam and Islamic world and Christian world, imaginary entities, is relying on a fiction. So the assumption is that from Muhammad day one, there was always a conflict between the Muslim world and the rest. It tells the story that for a millennium, since Muhammad, that Muslims always lived in kind of different imperial settings. They lived in close proximity with non-Muslims. And that this global imagination didn't exist, that imperial identities, especially after the Mongolian period, the Ottomans, Safavids, Mughals, created a different form of political imagination. That even Muslim dynasties were primarily imperial. They were primarily Ottoman, Mughals, Safavids. They didn't think of themselves belonging to a global geopolitical unity in relation to an enemy. And the term Ummah has been used for very different purposes and for very different contexts, religious contexts. I mean, the book mentions how Prophet Muhammad said that he will gather his Ummah in the hereafter. But that Ummah is pious people across many generations. It doesn't say that the Ummah is marked on a map with a temporal limit and with a clear enemy. So in this case, it's the West. And so book reminds people first that in the 16th, 17th, or 18th century, the idea of the Muslim world wouldn't have made sense to people. And then this way it makes the case that it's the late 19th century that where we see the origins of that term in a particular context. One chapter of the book also makes the suggestion that first response to European imperial expansion was not pan-Islamism. And that actually should also give a clue about the importance of empires. That when Napoleon was in Egypt, or even when French was in Algeria, or in 1857, Indian War of Independence against the British, we don't see some sort of global notions of a Muslim solidarity against the Christian empires. We see the first cases of a notion of an Islamic world emerging in 1870s and 1880s, and it has something to do with the connectivity of the Muslim populations through steamships and telegraph and printing, but within an imperial context, and try to explain how that imperial context worked.
And you describe how it was a kind of symbiosis, really, that, you know, with this encounter between expanding European empires and often subject Muslim populations, this narrative kind of became, it took on a momentum of its own on both sides, and they both kind of used it, or different figures within those two entities used it for their own purposes. Could you just talk about this kind of symbiotic nature in these early years, in the late 19th century, when this idea of a discrete Muslim world was with unique shared characteristics across vast regions, when that began to take root?
Yes, this is, I think, is an important turning point in the book. Even though we might think that it's the British or French, especially the British, who's going around the world from Africa to Asia to establish trade colonies and then imperial possessions, they were the ones who were marking Muslims and seeing connections, you know, Muslims in Africa, Muslims in the Ottoman lands, in India, in Southeast Asia. There's this external inscription of Muslimness as an identity marker. For whatever the reason, that the Muslimness was the primary marker for European observers who looked at different, very diverse societies. You know, Ottomans were different. Ottoman Empire had no connection with, let's say, Nigeria or Senegal, and they had little connection with you know, some part of India. That Ottomans had never ruled them. They were different empires and kingdoms. Well, this is happening. Gradually empowering Muslim publics embrace this externally ascribed idea of the Muslim world in order to talk back against European racism. And this is a very important turning point. And it probably happened at the same time for the idea of Asia, for Hindus, for Jews, in the sense that this 1880s generation of well-educated Muslim intellectuals who can print, publish, who travel around in steamships, who are better connected, who follow the news in the world with, you know, the news that telegraph empowers, who have discontents about racism of the empires, whether French, Russian, or British, but who are not necessarily imagining a post-imperial world yet. They are interested in empowering the Muslims within the empire, and who are talking back or rejecting European racial discourses of Muslim inferiority. It's this group, starting with Afghani up to Sayyid Ahmed Khan, Sayyid Amir Ali, these are the founding fathers of Muslim modernism, who also thought that the idea of a Muslim world with its civilization, with its universal religious values, would actually be a good way to tell the kind of European imperial elites that their racism is irrational, illogical, and false, that Muslims are actually equal to Christian whites. And the idea of Islam as a world religion, Islam as a civilization, is kind of helping to embracing the notion that Muslims are connected from Senegal to Morocco, Istanbul and Delhi, but also helping to give Muslims a sense of empowerment, a collective bargaining, and a good intellectual tradition to talk back, to articulate their vision of the world and their critique of the racialized empires.
And you narrate how the idea of the Muslim world was kind of instrumentalized in a way by various empires. And you spend time in a particularly fascinating section, I think, on the First World War and the German Empire's push for the Ottoman Empire to declare jihad. It was really a German idea to push the Ottoman state into declaring this global jihad. You quote Kaiser Wilhelm as saying that he wanted to provoke the whole Mohammedan world into a wild revolt against the British Empire and the French Empire. And this was kind of seen as a possible strategic step that they could take to gain an upper hand. And this kind of thing had never really been done before, and it certainly hadn't been manipulated. And the irony is, of course, that the Germans themselves were Christians. And could you just talk a bit about this a little, what that declaration of jihad kind of represented during the First World War, and how it was something new that wouldn't have made sense in previous generations? Yeah.
No, this is a very important point, and I give the example of Sultan Abdülhamid, who ruled the Ottoman Empire from 1876 all the way to 1909. It's a long period of time, and this is the period when the idea of the Muslim world and pan-Islamism emerged. And Sultan Abdülhamid was alive at the time of this jihad declaration, although he wasn't the Sultan anymore. And when the news came, he was really disturbed. He says, you know, this idea of an Islamic world and the Muslim world which he created partly. It was an idea with a name but without a body. And what are these young Turks, these kids are doing? That he kind of expresses his surprise and dissatisfaction. In that chapter, try to explain that we kind of misperceive Abdülhamid's pan-Islamism from the perspective of the 1914 jihad. We attribute a lot of ideas of 1914 jihad of Islam versus the Christian imperial West to Abdülhamid's pan-Islamism. In contrast, I argue that Abdülhamid, of course, wouldn't have imagined that the imperial world will end. He was a very imperial person, and his main job was to keep the integrity of the Ottoman Empire. As a Muslim monarch, Ottomans are ruling Armenians and Greeks and Christians. So his job was to, you know, is the preservation of the empire. So his pan-Islamism is basically recognizing that British Empire is the greatest Muslim empire in the world. And it was true that Queen Victoria ruled more Muslims than any other monarch in world history up to that time. And Queen Victoria ruled four times more Muslims than Abdülhamid did. So what he was saying with pan-Islamism is that this could be the basis of an Ottoman-British cooperation and alliance. And there's, of course, this fear of Russia, which was itself another Muslim empire. They had a lot of Muslim subjects. France claimed to be another Muslim empire. And since nationalism was not that powerful yet, people imagined the world to be this world of empires. And Abdülhamid's pan-Islamism was imagining an Islamic world in which he is a spiritual sovereign, but he's using his spiritual sovereignty not to provoke jihad, but to create inter-imperial peace and cooperation. He is the last person who wants wars among empires, and he wants actually kind of this Muslim mobility, connectivity to work for peace and cooperation among empires so that you avoid wars. That, of course, would work, and there are a lot of British elites who believed in that, including Churchill, and it was actually the British officers who believed that British alliance with the Ottomans would serve the British interest, that you're a friend of the Muslim Sultan and the Caliph, and this, therefore Indian Muslims should be loyal to the Queen or the King. But it will also provoke, this same idea provokes some sort of paranoia, because if Muslims are asserting their connection to the Ottoman Sultan as a Caliph, that makes the other empires nervous. You know, what does that mean? Because the Ottoman Sultan is also the Sultan of the Armenians and Greeks, and he's an imperial leader. Why would you give the Sultan that kind of spiritual sovereignty over your own imperial subjects? And in that context, Indian Muslims and Indonesian ones, or even the Muslims in the French Empire, they like this idea of a Sultan's spiritual sovereignty, because they thought it proves that there could be a Muslim monarch who is civilized and modern. And that means that the Muslims are not racially inferior. They could also have their political agency in modernity. We forget how much of Ottoman Sultan was a modern of cosmopolitanism and modernity up to World War I in some ways. Indian Muslims, for example, were very proud that the Sultan Caliph had Christian, Armenian or Greek ministers and ambassadors. And they will ask, you know, you think Ottomans is a bad empire, but he makes Christians ministers and ambassadors. Where is the Hindu or Muslim ministers and ambassadors of the British Empire? So this connectivity between Indian Muslims and the Ottoman Empire also not necessarily anti-imperial. It has something to do with the politics of race and Muslim dignity. So from there, I moved to try to explain what went wrong, why did the empires were in a clash in World War I, and try to explain why this imperial geopolitics eventually overwhelmed the imperial rationality, overwhelmed by the imperial geopolitics and racial thinking, you know, like Kaiser Wilhelm, thinking that, yes, the Islamic world exists under British Empire, but that might be the weak spot of the British. And if you have a war with the British, why don't you just provoke the Muslims to rebel against you? And it seems the young Turks basically took the Abdülhamid's framework, but reinterpreted together with Germans. So instead of seeing the Islamic world as a baby, of Ottoman-British cooperation under joint custody in their mind. Young Turks and the Germans thought that, well, I can ask that Islamic world to revolt against the British. You know, there's some sort of a pragmatic aspect to this. They're aware of this. And I try to emphasize that initially, I think Indian Muslims were very upset and very worried about this invitation, because they insisted on their dual loyalty, that they could be loyal subjects of the British Empire and they could also show their respect and religious loyalty to the caliph. The last thing they wanted is a war between the Ottomans and the British. They immediately write back, and you know, they say that just jihad is unacceptable, and French Muslims and Russian Muslims do the same thing. But the irony of history, of course, it comes in the next chapter, is that with the imperial war among these empires, the whole imperial system collapses and their legitimacy becomes weaker. And for Muslims, the bigger turning point is actually British Empire's betrayal of a kind of contract and promises to the Muslims. They perceive that contract, and they emphasize it many, many times in 1914, that despite Ottoman jihad, Indian Muslims will remain loyal to the British in return for British respecting Muslim holy cities and respecting the caliph. And I think anti-colonialism becomes stronger among Muslims in the British Empire because they feel Balfour Declaration, Sykes-Picot, or the Arab Revolt are all a bit kind of violations of the British promises to Muslim subjects.
Just going back to the First World War, of course, that was when just before, really, the Ottoman Empire finally collapsed. And I'm thinking, as I was reading the book, about a lot of popular media coverage of problems in the Middle East today. And one thing that often comes up is this idea of tracing current troubles back to this era, and often referring to the kind of the nation state order that emerged after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And kind of a subtext of this narrative is often this idea that people are imagining that there was a kind of unity of administration in all the nation states that emerged from the rubble of the Ottoman Empire, when in fact there was, you know, many different orders, and going back centuries, you had shifting alliances in the region. I mean, I wonder if you could just talk about that aspect as well, you know, this idea that the Ottoman Empire almost has come to be seen as this single authority in the region that was the political sovereign of a very wide expanse of land.
Yeah.
And this doesn't quite fit what the reality was, which was a lot more murky.
No, absolutely. I think you emphasize a very important point. I mean, when I observe what's happening in contemporary memories of World War One and Muslim history, I'm very disturbed how there's a narrative that the end of the Ottoman Empire is the end of the Muslim unity. And then people who say that is just focusing on the kind of tragic history of the Arab Middle East after the end of the Ottoman Empire. And it is true that for the Arab Middle East, it is, you know, there is some sort of more division, at least Iraq and Syria, Jordan and Palestine, and Hijaz were connected under Ottomans. But people who say that, they forget that the actually bigger partitions were separation of Turks and Greeks, also the Armenians, the presence of Armenians in Anatolia. People who remember the end of the Ottoman Empire as the end of the Arab unity never talk about this. These are actually more important turning points, these multiple partitions of Anatolian Greeks and Turks, and the end of Ottoman cosmopolitanism is a bigger story which is completely lost in contemporary historical memory of nationalism. And the second important point to remind us is that at the beginning and even at the end of the World War One, the Ottomans were not the biggest empire ruling over Muslims. In fact, it's the British. So the narrative that the Muslims were united, imperialism divided them, is not true. They were always divided among empires and kingdoms. Temporarily, the British united half of the Muslims, unintentionally, obviously, around Indian Ocean. And actually, after World War One, Britain makes connection between Arabs in the Middle East and India too, so that Palestinians and Pakistanis or Palestinians and Indians are connected through empire, through London. So the British Empire becomes even a bigger Muslim empire after World War One. But they have some sort of a big damage on their legitimacy. They have more difficulty in kind of convincing that this empire is fair to Muslims, right? That's the turning point. The narrative of Sykes-Picot divided the united Ummah is not true. I think that's what ISIS and Daesh ISIS is doing, right? They are symbolically declaring that they will reunite Iraq and Syria to eliminate the divisions of Sykes-Picot, whatever they are interpreting. But Sykes-Picot is one of the many factors that led to the current borders in the Middle East. And it's much more complex, actually. Sykes-Picot's vision was not implemented. Many other things happened, right? That Saudi Arabia, for example, is not a product of Sykes-Picot. There are other border adjustments, and Lausanne in Turkish Republic is actually eliminated some of the rules of the visions of the Sykes-Picot. So I'm trying to invite contemporary publics and intellectuals to think more critically about this dominant narrative of empires dividing Muslims. It might, you know, when you get to from 1920s to 40s, maybe that you can think of in terms of South Asia, right? The South Asia division of Muslims and Hindus that I think is a bigger story, how potentially the biggest Muslim nation state, India, are divided now into three pieces. But that also is a different politics that requires revisioning or revisiting the big narratives that many different political groups are trying to propagate today.
Just going back as well, one of the most important instances of this, of the idea of the Muslim world was of course during the Cold War. And you describe how there was a US report published in 1957 that was really, really influential in setting the course of US policy towards what it saw as the Muslim world during the Cold War. And it saw the world's 350 million Muslims as being this kind of, as having these shared characteristics that could make them important allies against the Soviet Union, based on this kind of simplistic idea that they formed this coherent bloc with shared fundamental characteristics. And this kind of thinking led to an unofficial alliance with Islamists in various parts of the world during the Cold War. Could you just talk about how this iteration of the idea of the Muslim world played out during the Cold War?
Yes, no, this is the last two chapters. This is the big story that I will try to tell. If the Ottoman-British alliance was Muslim World 1.0, like the first Muslim world, the pattern that emerges from that story is that something that came out as a vision or a justification for an Ottoman-British alliance against Russia turns against Britain with the intervention of Germans and the Ottoman, like Young Turk-German alliance against Britain. What does appear ironically similar is that the Muslim World 0.2 is actually emerges as an American-Saudi alliance, justification for an American-Saudi alliance against both the communist Soviet Union, but also against Nasser, who was seen as an ally, the strong Arab nationalist ally of the Soviet Union, then turned anti-American after Camp David and after the Iranian Revolution. Coincidental or similarity also have some sort of intellectual lineage and continuities. So the idea of the Muslim world after the end of the Ottoman Empire and the Turkish government abolishing the caliphate went into this 20-30 years period where the Muslim world seemed to be real as a big body, global body, without a kind of head and a voice and a representative. But then after World War II, there's this period where actually this idea of the Muslim world could fade away and people had some sort of different nationalist geopolitical imaginations. So I focus on how this memory, this template, this framework has been picked up by Saudi Arabia in order to empower itself both against Nasser, but also to make Saudi Arabia as a great regional power with encouragement and in alliance with the United States. And so the Saudi King Faisal emerges somebody like an Abdulhamid II 100 years later, 80, 90 years later, who is establishing new networks, who's thinking that a new nationalized Muslim world bloc could emerge at the United Nations. He's not thinking imperially, he's thinking based on the nation states. But he wants to make the Muslim countries at the UN emerge as a force in international politics, while, of course, is making Saudi Arabia a key player. And there is definitely a sense of an alliance of that Muslim internationalism against Nasser's third world pan-Arab and socialist internationalism. And there are so many other subaltern local Muslims who are interested in that idea. They think other internationalism failed. Once it's revived, then there are more more actors trying to push it in different directions. And I think eventually a crisis in the Middle East around Arab-Israeli wars, especially after Camp David and after Iranian Revolution and Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, gave a completely different meaning to this idea of the new Muslim world in the post-colonial Cold War context.
At the end of the book, you talk about ISIS. Of course, it's a very headline-grabbing phenomenon in recent years. But it's also a very good example, I think, of how this illusion really of the Muslim world has kind of gotten out of hand. And you say, I quote, its ideology relies on an ahistorical caricature of the caliphate, one that seems more derived from Islamophobic stereotypes than actual Abbasid or Ottoman practices. Could you just expand on this idea a bit? How, very ironically, this kind of symbiotic notion of ISIS having this idea of a caliphate, which really has no historical precedence and is really a very modern phenomenon, actually.
Yeah, of course. I think they. So I tried to indicate this problem of historical amnesia, how narratives and stories, both Muslims and the non-Muslims, create about Muslim politics and Muslim history, became so dehistoricized and become abstracted, and as if there's this direct connection between early Muslim society after Muhammad and modern Muslim politics, as if the 1,400 years of historical experience did not mean anything. That Akbar in India or Suleiman the Magnificent in the Ottoman Empire, their lives and their experience mean nothing, or even the 19th century Ottoman Tanzimat mean nothing. But if you're a good Muslim, you have to go back to early Islam. These are all new ideas, and it all kind of inherit this overutilized and overexploited framework, Islamic world and the West. But I'm very puzzled with amnesia. For example, ISIS, if they ever read anything about the Ottoman sultans, they might clearly declare them infidels. That, for example, Abdulhamid, the person who many Muslims remember as the pious caliph who created this idea of Muslim solidarity in their own way, was a fan of European opera music, and he had no intention of imposing Sharia on everybody. Right? That early Muslim modernists who were pan-Islamists for caliphate, their politics were completely different than the post-Wahhabi, post-Salafi idea of good Muslim is the one who imposes very strict interpretation of Sharia on everybody in a nation-state politics. And what happened with ISIS, of course, is more importantly, they are a product of the chaos and the proxy wars and invasions and occupations of Iraq and Syria in the last 5 years or 10 years. You can expand the period. But what does happen as a result is that up to ISIS, people had at least a vision of a different world, a utopia. And this idea of a Muslim world and pan-Islamism, from the Muslim perspectives, were at least another way of thinking about the future of the world, their empowerment, their rights. So you can actually read good things in each episode, whether it's the imperial era, pan-Islamism, and the idea of the Muslim world as an empowerment of racialized, colonized Muslims, or even the nation-state era one with King Faisal and others, and Pakistan did a little bit too, that kind of international cooperation among Muslims will actually make them less oppressed by the two superpowers, and they can help the Palestinians and others. But what we see now is that this utopian element about the good future is also lost. I think ISIS turned the chaos and destruction and dystopia of the Middle East into their nihilistic utopia, saying that, well, we will just use this caricaturized caliphate as our ideal goal, and we don't care whether we create a better world for the future. It is, I do become very pessimistic, and in the book you can see the pessimism in the last chapter, in a way that how multiple generations that utilize certain notions of Muslim politics and based with their amnesia created this senseless political chaos. I don't mean to say the Muslims are only to blame for this, but the whole international community, starting with the UN and the great powers and their foreign policies, created a very dark present in certain parts of the Middle East. And we really need to do something urgently. And as scholars, we can do some sort of intellectual self-reflection. But beyond scholars, I think all of us have to think and work hard to help the people who are really affected by these dark periods.
That was Cemil Aydın. Thank you very much to him. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Also, remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page, or do both, to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thanks very much for listening. Telli manam, tellidir, tellidir aman.